been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the face of the men who sent the news to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments are killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance.
August 21st, 2003, marks 11 years since the federal government siege on the home of Randy Weaver and his family at Ruby Ridge, Idaho. The Weavers have disappeared down an Orwellian memory hole for most Americans. You see, their story doesn't offer an occasion for waving flags and singing patriotic songs. In fact, despite the tragedy that befell the Weaver family, Randy Weaver is still vilified by major media and so-called liberals for his crimes and strange beliefs. Those crimes and strange beliefs include distrust of your government. Randy Weaver had reason to distrust his government. In 1991, an agent of the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the BATF, entrapped Weaver by hiring to cut off the barrels of two shotguns illegally. Once Weaver was arrested, BATF attempted to force him to inform on the Aryan Nations Group, an association with which he was affiliated, or allegedly affiliated, but Randy refused. Weaver also refused to appear in court for the minor firearms charge, and for the next 18 months, the U.S. Marshals Service spied on the Weaver's isolated mountain cabin, where Randy lived with his wife Vicky, son Sammy, age 14, daughters Sarah, 16, Rachel, 10, and baby Elisheba, age 10 months, and a young friend named Kevin Harris. And then came August 21st, 1992. On that morning, six trained government marksmen wearing ski masks and camouflage and armed with automatic weapons equipped with silencers crept up on the Weaver cabin without warning or warrant and without identifying themselves. First, they shot and killed the family's yellow Labrador Striker, who had been barking at the intruders. And when young Sammy witnessed this, he fired a .223 Mini 14 in the direction from which the shots had come, and then ran back to the cabin. Agents shot Sammy in the arm, knocking him down. The youngster got back to his feet and began running again. Moments later, a second gunshot caught Sammy in the back, killing him. Within 24 hours, one deputy U.S. Marshal was dead, and some 400 federal agents were arriving at the scene, along with a helicopter, Humvees, armored transport vehicles, and personnel carriers. The Weaver's dead dog was left in the road and repeatedly run over by government vehicles. And on the afternoon of August 22nd, Vicky Weaver, standing at the cabin's kitchen door and armed with nothing more lethal than baby Elisheba, was shot in the head by a government sniper. The round hit Vicky in the temple, traveled through her mouth, tongue, and jawbone, and then severed her carotid artery. Kneeling on the floor and still clutching her baby, Vicky Weaver bled to death. 9 days later, Weaver, a badly wounded Harris, and the surviving children surrendered to federal agents. The occasion was October of 1998. I was attending a preparedness expo as a vendor and was privileged to meet for the second time a lovely young woman, lovely considering what she'd gone through, but in so many other ways, Sarah Weaver. That, my friends, is the purpose of this hour, to share with you that 45-minute interview that we conducted with Sarah Weaver on that day so many years ago. Listen carefully to these words from a then 22-year-old Sarah Weaver.
Ruby Ridge is a name fabricated by the press, and even though it is incorrect, it is a name that will forever be burned into the memories of many people. Those words were spoken or written by our guest today, who I will introduce in a moment, because I'm going to read a poem written by our guest. It's a very fitting opening, and I wish a closing to a horrendous story and a horrendous chapter in American history. You're listening to Perspectives on America. I'm your host this evening, Jeffrey Bennett. If you're listening on the shortwave, we're on WWCR Worldwide Christian Radio, 3.215 megahertz on your shortwave dial. This program is also being taped for television, on public access television all over America. Its attempt, as with this program always is, to reach a segment of America who is uninformed, who's heard one side of any story we bring to you, and to bring the truth to you, something we hear little of in this nation today. The poem I share with you, and son of a gun, I lost the page. That's terrible. But while I'm looking for it, I'm going to interrupt. She knows where it is. Thank you. What are you going to do? Where are we all headed? I call it the yellow brick road to hell. Jesters prowl the alleyways looking for souls to sell. Demons adorned with glowing eyes hunt you in the night. Your thoughts are scattered in the wind. There's only room for fright. They've stolen your souls and held you in chains, feasting upon your fear. They never fail to remind you the grim reaper is always near. There's no one to stop the madness except one, and that is you. Will your fear let them continue the game? What are you going to do? Our guest today is Sarah Weaver. That name may mean very little to many of you. The name Ruby Ridge may mean a lot to most of you, and should. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you.
This is Sarah and I met some months ago in Washington. It was an honor. I can't say it was a treat under the circumstances, you know that. It's a very, very difficult subject to cover. You have a horrendous story that I would not wish anyone to live through in this nation. No one anywhere in the world should have to live through your story. And I don't know where to begin but to ask you to share with us and share with our viewers what you're comfortable sharing with them. You lived through, with your family, a phenomenal tragedy that began in 1992, is that right?
Yeah, August.
And during the course of that, you lost your mother. You lost your younger brother, who, according to what I read in the book, was probably your best friend, your best buddy.
Yeah, he was, without a doubt.
And the media, as we know the media in this country today, had a field day from that first day with their own brand of reporting. Hollywood has managed to do a pretty poor movie about your story. You and your father have written a book entitled The Federal Siege at Ruby Ridge. What was the reason you did the book?
Oh, we were tired of hearing everyone else's version, everyone else's description of our family, what they thought we were like, how they perceived us to be. Nobody ever really asked us. They just...
Unfortunately, as we've discussed, the media in this country today tends to put their slant on all forms of news, whether it's your story, whether it's what we all witnessed some years later in Waco, Texas, which you've certainly made reference to that in your book. It seems to me, and I'm paraphrasing because the specific words escape me, obviously your hopes and desires in the book were not only to tell your story and the story of your father, your mother, your sisters, and Sam, Kevin, Colonel Greitz, Jack McLam, so many different players in this story in one form or another. What has the reaction been to the book so far?
It's been great.
You've had good support?
Absolutely.
What kind of comments are the people giving you? I mean, are they just amazed that this is so completely different than what they've been told?
Yeah, I've had a few people come to me after reading the book and say, I have totally changed my opinion of your family.
Well, my opinion has never changed. It's never any different than it is today. I think you know that. I thank you for doing this program with me because I know it's not easy. I know you don't like to do interviews, you know, and that's okay. I made some promises to you that I will not break. I'm concerned for the family. Your younger sister, Rachel, still is very, very withdrawn. Really doesn't want to come out of her shell. And what about your little sister? How old is she now?
Seven. Well, she will be seven.
She'll be seven?
The 24th.
She, I guess, in some respects, thank God, probably doesn't remember most of it.
No, but she hears a lot. And that's rough on her. And it's rough on her to have friends that have their mothers around. She clings twice as hard to my dad because of that, I think.
You eventually moved to Iowa for a while and lived with your aunt?
Yeah, my grandparents and then my aunt.
The one thing I found profound in the book is you're, for the first time in your life, going to public school. You were raised homeschooled. Your mother was your teacher.
Yep.
And the treatment that you were given by fellow students, I guess I can use that word, was pretty horrific unto itself, wasn't it?
I don't remember specific times being like harassed. I think I was more ignored than anything.
So they just kind of shunted you as what, like a freak or something? Or
well,
what?
No, I didn't really fit in anywhere. And it was tough for me to adjust to all the social aspect, and I didn't know where to fit in. And the teachers were all wonderful. They all knew who I was. But it was tough for me to sit at home at night and at 5 o'clock see my dad on TV in chains and then go to school the next day and see all of the kids, you know.
How is your father these many years later getting through? How's he managing? How's he balancing? I shared with you the other day when we spoke. I don't see your father as the same Randy Weaver that I saw testifying before Congress.
He's hurting. He'll never probably stop hurting. My mom was his soulmate, and she's gone. And he probably will never find someone like her again. He can't hold anybody up to those expectations, but he's still hurting.
That.
You never get over this, ever.
Obviously, for other reasons. I think a segment of America is also still hurting. Certainly not in the way that you and your family do or will. I read this book some months ago when I first got a copy of it from you in Washington. I did a pretty intense re-review of it last night. There's so much that goes through my head. Sometimes I don't know the right questions to ask. I'd like to kind of digress and maybe get away from some of this. Yes, the book spells so much out of what you experienced during those horrible days. Maybe you can share with our viewers today that much that you want to share with them. Your side of what you saw, what you witnessed, what you experienced. And if you need to stop, you let me know. We'll do that. I told you.
Okay.
Talk to us about that first day. It started with literally with your dog being killed.
Yeah. We weren't expecting what happened that day, that's for sure. I just seemed like a normal day at first. And the dog started barking, and which was normal because we lived in the mountains and he did it all the time. My brother said, I'm going to go check it out. I'm going to follow Stryker and see what he's barking at. And I was just, okay, you know, see you later. It was no big deal. My dad followed him and Kevin followed him, and I just hung around the house outside and
Did Kevin live with the family? Or was
he
just, he did?
Off and on.
Kind of like a big brother, maybe?
He lived with us off and on from when he was 16 up until it happened. He was 24. He was definitely, he's family to me.
That's good. That's good.
I love him like a brother.
You were upstairs in the cabin when your mother was killed, were you not?
No.
You were downstairs or you were outside?
I was outside.
It all starts to mix with me. I apologize.
That's okay. I had gone outside with my dad and with Kevin. This is the second day that happened. The dog again started barking. This was after Sam had been shot, and we were all just freaked out completely all night long. And the next day, nobody was around that we could tell. Nobody had come up and tried to knock on the door or talk to us with a bullhorn or anything. Dog was barking. We thought, okay, let's go outside and see if there's somebody out there. The dog quit barking. My dad walked away from me and went to where they had placed Sam in a shed outside and said he was going to say goodbye to him again. And
how old was Sam?
He was 14.
14 years old, and like the dog, shot in the back, basically.
He saw his dog shot down in front of him. The dog wasn't killed right away. It was laying there yelping. The dog had been shot up the rear. The dog confronted the guys. I guess the dog got scared. He was just a young lab. He wasn't that old. Had turned around, and this guy in full camouflage, and these woods are dark, just shot the dog in front of my brother. My brother fired back. And then my dad started yelling. He'd heard the gunshots and said, "Sam, Kevin, get home." My dad had split up from them. He was on another part of the property. And he had confronted an agent as well. Somebody had jumped out of the bushes at him and said, "Freeze," did not identify themselves. My dad said, "Forget it," and turned around and started yelling for Sam and Kevin. That's when the gunfire started. And the last thing my dad heard from my brother was, "I'm coming, Dad." And he turned around and started for home. They shot him in the back of the arm. Apparently that wasn't good enough. He was still running for home, and they shot him in the square of the back and basically blew out his heart.
We keep talking about they. We really are talking about government agents.
Yeah.
These are FBI?
No, I believe they were U.S. Marshals. Their purpose that day was to... Well, they'd done 18 months of surveillance on our cabin with cameras, and they were sneaking out in the woods, and we didn't know about it. But their purpose that day, they say, was to lure the dog out by throwing rocks at our property and shoot the dog with a silent submachine gun so we wouldn't have the dog to warn us.
Shoot a dog with a machine gun? That makes a lot of sense.
So we wouldn't have the dog to warn us when they were sneaking around out in the woods. Well, I guess the confrontation wasn't supposed to happen. And when it did, they handled it completely wrong. Their mission there was to shoot the dog, and they confronted the dog and my brother, and they shot the dog anyway instead of just leaving. It's a big mess.
In this past decade of the 90s, we've seen, as far as I'm concerned, a tremendous amount of abuse by, let's just call them government agents, because they really are. And I think that certainly a sounding cry, a warning cry, certainly was what happened at your cabin. You've referenced in the opening piece I read on the book that it really was not Ruby Ridge. That's what the press has named it. What was it? What was it called?
I think it was Caribou Ridge and Ruby Creek Drainage. Ruby Creek was a creek that just ran down the draw. We lived on top of a mountain, so... somebody picked up Ruby Ridge and the press just ran wild with it, and that's all anybody knows it now. It's kind of funny. It's just a label.
I guess it sells magazines or National Enquirers or something.
Well, you know that the press tends to get a lot of facts wrong when they initially start digging into something, and I think that's just a perfect example of not getting the whole story or the right, you know, facts before they send it to print.
I think what struck me first as I began to really pay attention, is not only the devastation that was wreaked upon a family who obviously is in total fear of God in so many ways, is the labels of white separatist, white supremacist.
They never labeled us separatist until the last couple of years. They finally got it straight. It was supremacist.
Which really bothered me, because I saw instantly through that one. A white supremacist could be looked upon as having leanings toward Nazism and skinheadism and all sorts of things. It became a word that some media guy got a hold of.
What bothers me the most is the fact that you have to have a label at all.
I know it.
I mean, when someone, you interview Joe Smith on the street, you don't say, this quote came from Joe Smith, Catholic or Baptist or Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You don't automatically label somebody by their religion.
Well, I want to touch on the label for a minute, just for our viewers, because I want to clarify something. Let's assume for a moment, let's just take the label white separatist. So what? Your father happens to be Caucasian or white, if you used to use the words, obviously, as is the rest of the family. What's the terminology separatist? Someone who is not comfortable with the system as he sees it growing and evolving, chooses to take his family to a beautiful, quiet, remote area to be left alone, to raise their family in peace and in love, who chooses to live separately from the rest of the world. Now, if people would look at the word, just forget the white portion, because I don't care if they're black, red, green, or yellow. This is not the issue. But let's just take the word separatist. That's a good word. There's nothing wrong with it if it's looked at in the proper context. Unfortunately, the mainstream media didn't approach it in the proper context. They made something evil and something dirty out of it.
It's buzzwords for shock value. I think people miss the wide scope of things. They focus on the smaller, less important things. The big picture is half of my family was murdered. This is America. You're supposed to be able to believe whatever you wish without being persecuted, as long as you are not harming anyone else in the process. My dad was not harming anyone. He committed a victimless crime. He didn't steal. He didn't rape. He didn't kill anyone. He sawed off a couple of shotguns for the money from a guy for 2 years that pressured him to do it. He thought the guy was his friend. He didn't have a job. He was trying to feed his kids. The guy said, I'll pay you a lot of money to do this for me. My dad said, okay. I think there's a lot of people in jail for victimless crimes right now, and there's a lot of criminals walking around on the street.
Some of them are walking around Washington, D.C.
My dad was facing the death penalty. They had charges against him. It is so ludicrous. He was conspiring to overthrow the United States government. One little man, his wife, and four kids. And one of the indictments was conspiring to overthrow the United States government. They even had my little sister indicted in the beginning until they realized that that was ludicrous. She was 10 months old.
You know, it's interesting. We talk about this conspiring to overthrow the government. You've attended a couple of preparedness expos now. They, of course, have had their own labels placed upon them as being gathering places for right-wing extremists, etc., etc. The two shows you've been to have been quite unique as these preparedness expos have developed over a 10-year period, in that about 60% of the people that have been coming to the expos are finally beginning to wake up and say, wait a minute, something's not right here. They're not just looking at things from a political aspect. They are beginning to realize that self-sufficiency and self-responsibility are a part of America that doesn't seem to exist any longer. They're coming to learn about food storage and gathering of food and water purification and legal issues and political issues, etc.
I think the preparedness expos are wonderful because people are afraid of their government right now. and they're turning to themselves. They're waking up to realize maybe I'll have to rely on myself and my own ingenuity to take care of myself if something goes wrong, instead of turning to my government for the help because it might not be there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that's great.
It goes back to what America was founded on, which really is not unlike what your father and mother were trying to do with you and your family.
But we were crazy to mainstream America. We lived with no electricity, on top of a mountain, no telephone. My dad homeschooled his children. And he taught us how to use a weapon. My dad was a gun collector. He liked guns. He was a Green Beret, and his thoughts were, if he's gonna have them in his house, he better teach responsibility to his children. I will always be grateful to him for that, because he could leave his home and not worry about one of us kids shooting each other or shooting ourselves. I think it's 100% worse for a parent to own a gun, not tell their child a thing about it, and the child has this curiosity factor. They'll pick up the gun, not know how to use it, not know what to do, and accidentally shoot one of their friends or themselves. My dad taught us safety and respect, and we did not touch them when they weren't home, you know?
You have the ability to protect yourself from intrusion, outside intruders.
But
you also have the ability to forage and hunt for food if necessary.
That even wasn't the concern. I hiked all over the mountains in Idaho, and they were transplanting grizzly bears, and we had mountain lions. The main reason I carried a weapon when I was hiking was to protect myself from an animal. And I would have not shot an animal if I came across it. If I came across a bear or a cat, I would have fired into the air and hopefully chased it away. I do not like confrontation, okay? I'm gonna turn the other way. But if you back me in a corner, I wanna know how to protect myself.
You're 22 now.
Yeah.
So you were, what, 14, 15 when all this
16.
Happened? How long have you been carrying a gun? At what age were you when you were taught gun safety and?
My dad started me out with a BB gun, and I was probably 9, and then probably about 12, a 22, and then from then it just kind of progressed.
It's interesting. I grew up with guns almost from the time I could crawl. My grandfather, who I spent a good number of my years with, was an avid gun collector. Guns from all over the world and all calibers, and many were used for hunting. He actually owned had an NRA-sanctioned rifle range at his place in Wisconsin. I grew up shooting there. I was given my first rifle at the age of 8. I, even though Wisconsin did much the same as you did, I hiked the hills and the mountains and fished, always carried a gun with me. And when you're a real young kid, it's kind of a fun thing. But years before I picked up my first gun, I mean a real one that I was able to actually hold and go out and shoot, I was taught tremendous safety lessons, something that is a big problem here in this country today, because we get off on the gun issues and the Second Amendment rights, and these are the things Gun Owners of America stands for. It's not about gun control, it's about controlling of the people. You learn things at a relatively early age that I learned. Kids aren't taught this stuff today. They're taught to go out and steal one so they can go ahead and hold somebody up to get dope or whatever else it is they need.
Well, you know, and I think common sense tells you that the criminals are always going to have them.
They're going to have weapons of one form or another. What's next, butter knives?
Well, people have always killed people. I mean, it's always going to happen, it always has, and it always will.
They did it with clubs, but they couldn't confiscate those.
Well, and it's going to happen whether you have guns or not. And I think, well, it goes back to the bumper sticker. Guns don't kill people, people kill people. And it wasn't, I mean, I don't know. It's a touchy subject. I've been in arguments with a lot of people about it. But it's a right. People ask me why I own a gun after what happened to my family. And to me, I say because it's my right. You know?
Good for you.
It's my right to believe what I want to without being persecuted for it. It's my right to carry a gun. It's my right to drive a car, as long as I'm not hurting or endangering someone else because of it.
Let me go back to a comment you made a few minutes ago. One of the accusations against your father is that he was conspiring to overthrow the government. I find that interesting, and I've been chastised for saying this, and I've said this on the air, both television and the radio. I maintain the government's already been overthrown. I want my government back. What do you say to that?
That actually is, if you think about it, you know, it makes sense. It's been overthrown by corrupt people whose major goal in life is money and power and fame. It's not definitely not run by people who care about their country or about the people in their country. I think the reason a lot of people are scared right now and coming to these expos, what happened to my family was horrible. It's going to go down in history as one of the most horrible things our government has done to its people. They haven't done anything to rectify what they've done. They haven't done anything to repair the damage. They've never apologized. They've never said, okay, this is wrong. We know this is wrong. Let's change things.
No, that because a few happened. Years later, they did a very similar thing down in Waco, Texas.
Actually, it was a few months later.
I guess it was a few months.
And it was the same people there that were at our house. And
Horiuchi was at both places?
I don't think Horiuchi was. I think it was the top.
I lose track of names after a while. Reno was not Attorney General at that time, was she? Janet Reno?
I know she was during Waco. I'm not sure if she was.
I think she was during Ruby Ridge. And see, I fall into the trap. There I go, Ruby Ridge. Sorry about that.
No, I mean, people know that name.
That's what they respond to. And there's some details that maybe aren't worth trying to retrain them or re-educate them.
Absolutely,
on.
Absolutely.
We've gone in this decade from your family's horror to the deaths of the people at Waco. The film Waco Rules of Engagement to me proves beyond a shadow of a doubt the government's culpability. And I don't care if people out there can say what they want. For those who have not seen the film, they should. I think they should not bother to see the Hollywood version of what your family went through. I saw it and wanted to vomit with it because I knew too much. I don't think you're even aware of just how much I knew when all of this uncovered. It was during your situation when I first met Colonel Grice. Not necessarily under the best of circumstances. The Colonel has a tremendous amount of controversy that always surrounds him, but a dedicated man he is. I think you know that. You've made some comments to me about the Colonel.
He saved my life and he saved the lives of what was left of my family members because he had the guts to go up and knock on our door. It would have been very easy for the government to waste Bo and say that we did it. He had the gut, he knew that, and he faced that, and he understood that, and he still walked up and knocked on our door and said, come on, I'm gonna get you out of here.
This is a tough question to ask you. There are those people in America who are skeptics about everything. There are those people who feel that Bo was a plant. What's your comment?
Bo,
you've had a lot of interaction with him over these years.
He's a very kind person. He has the biggest heart of anyone I've ever met. He'd do anything for anybody. And those people that say that, I'd like to ask them, what have they ever done for anyone? Bo has helped so many people throughout his life, and he continues to do so. What have they done for anyone?
Good for you. We're talking with Sarah Weaver on Perspectives on America. Sarah, of course, daughter of Randy and Vicki Weaver. And we'll be back after a brief intermission. We're back talking with Sarah Weaver. A conversation with Sarah. That's what I'm going to call this program. You know that. During the break, Sarah and I had a number of side conversations, and one of them is, I guess to a degree, an emotional one. You've done these expos. You say there's some things the expos are beginning to bring out of you. because I know you've had real problems dealing with the mainstream media. You spoke with our producer before we began filming today that you're used to getting up before 50 and 100 cameras and the flashbulbs are popping and the arrogance comes out and the words are twisted and no matter what you say and you can record it and you can play it back, but what they play is something completely different. What are the expos doing for you, meeting the people who think they know your story?
The expos have been great in a way. I had to get over major issues before I could do the expos because actually I had to get to a point where I didn't care anymore what was said about me or my family and stop worrying about how it was going to come out when I did say something because I was actually scared into silence. So every time I opened my mouth, it came out as something different on TV. Actually, a lot of the reporters I've dealt with were really, really sugary and nice when they talked to me. And then later on, they kind of molded the story to fit whatever they were trying to come about. So that made me distrust even talking to anyone on camera or with a microphone. But the expos have been...
That's why I feel privileged, and I thank you for that.
No problem. The expos have been great because the people have been supportive. Some of them can be rude. Some of them can be insensitive without realizing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that, and I forgive them for that. But for the most part, everybody's just wonderful. They shake your hands. I've had people come up and start actually crying before they've even said a word, being bugged here.
I didn't have an easy time the first time I met you with that either.
Well, and it shocks me because to have someone walk up to you and start bawling and say, I didn't know you were going to be here. I'm sorry. I'll come back when I can talk.
Do you know what they're crying for? Have you ever thought about it?
I've thought about it. I think you see something like what happened to us on TV, you never expect it to come home to you. And when you finally get that close to it, everything hits you all at once. Like, I haven't met any of the members that survived Waco, but I'm sure if I did, I would start bawling because I knew what they went through. Not all of it, but some of it.
Think about this for a minute. From a personal side, they're crying for you, for your sisters, for your father, for everything that happened. As you just said, if they meet people who survived Waco, yes, they would cry for that. It's a cry of shame in some respects.
I think relief.
Concern for you and your family, yes, to watch someone of your age to have gone through the hell that you've gone through. And like it or not, I told you this the other day, you're becoming stronger for it. It's something you're going to have to live with your whole life. But you are a survivor. And guess who taught you to be that way?
My parents did.
That's right.
Especially my mom.
That's right.
I think a lot of the reason people cry, they say that it could have been them, and they put their families in the situation, and they think how they would have felt, and that makes them cry.
There's another factor to this, Sarah. People who are aware of your story, no matter how truthful or how untruthful, they're aware of the story. They cry for young children who lost a mother. They cry for the breakup of the family in that respect. They cry for the perpetrators, the government agents that caused this, no matter what the reason was. Innocent until proven guilty is part of the law of this land. Those of us who are aware of your story cry for another reason. The death of America as we knew it. They see that through you, through your family. They see that in Waco as well. They see it in, and there's going to be some viewers here who are going to be angered by this next statement. They see it through the tragedy at Oklahoma City. Because the media had honed their craft and their skill by Oklahoma City so well that they instantly honed in on Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. And yet the proof the evidence is so unbelievable of government culpability or knowledge of what happened there. That is why I believe people cry when they meet you, because they really see the death of this nation, the final nail in the coffin of what this nation once stood for. Now, let's take this a step further. Obviously, you get the tears and the emotion from people who are aware of the story. What about those who are coming to the expo that this is a whole new thing to? Yes, they've heard of Ruby Ridge, they've heard of the Weavers. They're coming here for Y2K, they're coming here to buy food. Are you being approached by these people? Are they coming? And what kind of reaction are you receiving from them?
Pretty much the same. You know, a lot of them don't know all of the facts. They haven't studied it. They've just heard on TV or seen the movie. But they're open enough to buy the book and read the book and shake my hand. And I really appreciate that they can look at both sides and not be biased until they've had the complete story. I'm really happy that they can do that.
Children, you shared a story with me that happened the other day. I can't remember if it was a young girl or a young boy that had come up with their parents and really was very shy.
Yeah, he was. I think he was about 16. I've been in his shoes. He kind of...
Same age?
Yeah, I've been in his shoes at that age. Kind of awkward and
shy. You pray God
shy.
He's not in the shoes you were in at that age.
I pray it never happens to anyone ever again. That's why I'm talking about it. He walked up, his dad was just talking away to me and to my dad, and he hung around and he came back and he left and he came back a couple or three times to talk to us. And the whole while, I didn't even know the kid's name really until his dad said it. He didn't shake my hand or introduce himself or anything, and usually everybody does, so like I was kind of surprised, but he kind of hung around in the background. And I felt really bad. His dad was telling me about how he's in the ROTC and in high school, and I knew how awkward he felt. So I pulled out a picture of me. Don't know why anybody would want one. But I signed
it
to him.
Can I show it? Can I show the picture? You can let
me
do this?
No, I hate the one in the book.
Oh, come on. The one you gave me yesterday. Come on.
Okay. But anyway, I signed it.
We've got the real thing here.
I just did that this show because I had so many people asking me for photos. But anyway, I signed it to him. And I said something like, stand tall and never give up. And after that, it's like he walked up, he shook my hand, and he said thank you. And he seemed like he felt better. He walked a little bit taller and his head was a little bit higher. And I felt really, really good to be able to do that. He made my day. He really did.
I know the feeling. As a broadcaster, and I shared this with you yesterday, I meet a lot of the people who listen to my program, in some cases view it, and I had a young boy come up yesterday named Cody, probably about 12 years old, and asked me to sign his program for the expo. And that really took me back. Once in a while I'll get that, because I just don't get caught up in all of that. And I talked to the young boy for a while, and he had a big grin on his face, and just, you know, I said, "Would you listen to the program?" He says, "My parents and I listen to you every night, Mr. Bennett." And at that instant, not that I haven't realized it in the past, I realized that's what all of this is about, is the children. I don't make a difference. Maybe some of the things I say do, and in the way people think or they act or react, it's the kids, it's the future. And like it or not, you're still a kid to me. And
I don't feel like it. I feel like I'm about 45.
I know. Oh, boy, I must be ancient. I'm 51, Sarah. It's okay. But that's the realization. It's really the kids. But you've got a younger sister, Rachel, who is really still having a very tough time with all of this. Doesn't want anything to do with the book, doesn't really want to answer the phone or help out.
She does. She does real good for under the circumstances, though.
That's good.
She just has a hard time with it. She has a hard time going to school and knowing that everybody there knows who she is. And she's 17. I was at that age. That's what I wrote about in the book. about school, how much I hated it, because it just, I didn't fit in anywhere. Rachel actually is better off than I was because she got started younger. So she's in with the cool crowd, you know, and I think she's going to be okay, but, you know, she's never going to get over this either. And she was only 10 years old at the time.
But you know what, Sarah Weaver, I think you're going to be okay too. I think you're doing fine.
I hope so.
Nobody can ever do perfect or great in this life, not after going through something like that. I've watched your metamorphosis just in the 3 months since I first met you. You're a different person now than you were 3 months ago. And yet our relationship is different than 3 months ago. When we first met, you were kind of shy, but I understood why. I never took it personally. I've shared that with you. It's the media stigma. And thank God, I don't consider myself media. Yes, I do radio and I do television. The family's all back together again now, is that right? Your dad and the girls, all three of you?
Yeah, I have my own place, but my two sisters live with him.
But you're all close geographically?
Yeah, I'm only about 11 miles
Because it
away.
Wasn't that way for a while, was it?
No, not when Dad was in jail. We were in Iowa and he was in Idaho. And then he moved back to Iowa, and he moved to Grand Junction while I stayed in high school. That was about 40 minutes away.
Well, at that point, there had been enough change in your life. The decision was maybe you ought to just finish high school where you were.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Yep.
Okay. How, you know, Rachel's in regular school now?
Yep.
Public
school? She's in
high school.
She's a junior. She gets good grades.
What are you going to do with the little one when it's time for school?
She's
gonna go
in
to
first grade,
school?
Yeah.
Public
already,
school?
Mm-hmm. Yep. She's dying to learn how to read.
Really? Good mm-hmm. for her. Good for her. Big sister trying to help her?
Oh, I don't get to see her that much.
You're traveling too much. You're a road groupie now.
Well, not only that, but she's got her own little circle of friends, and she's off on the weekends and here and there and everywhere, so.
What's in the future for the Weaver family?
I don't know. I honestly can say that I don't know. Beyond the next show I've got scheduled, I don't know. I mean, my life keeps taking these crazy turns and ups and downs, and I don't know. I've tried to settle down and run away and hide for a while, but that just doesn't seem to work. I guess when you write a book, it's kind of self-inflicted, but...
The book was designed to maybe be a closure? Although it'll never be a closure, you know that.
The book was so nobody would ever try. We're trying to make sure nobody ever forgets what happened, especially the government. I think they'd like us to shut up and go away.
My friends, today, Weaver is more optimistic than I am, believing the system will work. I guess maybe he's more forgiving, too. In 1995, congressional hearings into the Weaver tragedy revealed a cover-up, but the feds refused to prosecute the killers of Sammy and Vicki Weaver. Case closed. And despite all the evidence of government wrongdoing, those of us who now mention the name Randy Weaver are generally dismissed as right-wing, gun-toting conspiracy nuts. Today, while the Weaver story has fallen through the cracks of history, most Americans look toward the anniversary of 9/11 and demand that the government do something, anything, to protect them from foreign terrorists, highly trained assassins wearing ski masks and camouflage and armed with automatic weapons equipped with silencers. As for me, I will, each and every year, respectfully observe the 9/11 memorials. But, you see, I also intend to take a few minutes on August 21st, the anniversary of the siege at Ruby Ridge, to ponder how best to tell the bad guys from the good guys during these difficult times, and to wonder how wise it is to demand that one band of murderous thugs protect us from another. Without apology, I am Jeffrey Bennett.
In the mountains up near Sandpoint, north of Naples, Idaho, eagles gathered there together to guard the truth so you might know. Down the road that followed Deep Creek, at the turn that crossed the bridge, federal marshals had the roadblock to mark.
marked the siege of Ruby Ridge. There the armies of the enemy slayed your bride and only son. Nearly killed your close companion when the shrapnel pierced his lung. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is. On that evening, late one August, you were forced to take your stand. There two strangers, as they trespassed, drew first blood on private land. Governor Andrus, back in Boise, he let the enemy tell him lies. And from his anti-Christ decision, Sam and Vicky lost their lives. Federal agents, U.S. Marshals, and FBI men stormed the hill, all on false, fictitious charges, given orders shoot to kill. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is.